I was one of the questions.
So we are going to.
I'm glad you're doing
we approve
that.
All I see is a sign that says do not touch.
You have to do the mouse.
Where's the mouse?
You could do the mouse for the pointer. And how measure
really?
Yeah.
So where?
Okay,
no, I can't.
Sure.
Oh, there.
There you go. But
we don't have a. So just forward, back.
Yeah.
If I hit that,
yeah.
Smoke comes out of the screen.
Watch your
okay, we're going to try to get regrouped here.
Give me, if you do something wrong, you can
noting
give me the...
We're running a little longer than...
Chill sign.
Running a little longer than planned. We'll have staff get the forms for a lunch.
Yeah, I'm going to make note with staff that Board Member Abacobi had an appointment with the City of Mountain View and had to roll, too. So she's no longer here.
But we do remain with a quorum.
We still have a quorum. And at this time, we will move on to... Item 5B. Now, were we going to approve the consent calendar on that?
We already approved 5A. So
you're right.
5B open, and I think it's appropriate to recognize that Alan Freeman, who will give a staff presentation on this, was not here when you did the swearing in. So if you can do a quick read through to make sure we're clean on that for him.
Since he was off to Harvard for his fifth grade graduate.
Test, I actually was there.
All relevant evidence that any person's desire to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, and third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board council may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath of office to tell the truth. And I believe we might have another individual that came in later. Yep. Okay, good. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in this hearing will now rise or raise their hand, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. I think we're covered with everyone's forehand. So welcome.
Thank you. And good morning to you, Chairman Mueller and members of the board. My name is Alan Freedman. And this is item 5B, which proposes revised site cleanup requirements for the Pacific Rod and Gun Club and the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, who are also known and identified as the dischargers for this case. This slide, if you can see behind you, shows the location of the club, a 14-acre site on the southwest shore of Lake Merced, which is a freshwater lake in the southwest corner of San Francisco, rather close to the ocean, as you can see. Now, the site is owned by the City and County of San Francisco, and currently the landlord and site manager is the San Francisco PUC. The Gun Club has conducted skeet and trap shooting at the site since 1934 at this current location. Now, we've got an aerial shot of the site. I forgot the laser pointer, but I hope you can see the computer pointer. Historically, the club used shotguns to fire lead shot at clay targets that contained PAHs, or polycyclic hydrocarbons. What you see in this aerial view is the club, which is in the center portion of the slide. These numbers are the various firing positions, and they fire out towards the lake, which is at the bottom. As a result of these activities, the upland soils and sediments of the lake have become contaminated with lead and the PAHs. This residual contamination poses a risk to both the human users of the site as well as to wildlife in the lake. It was estimated at one point that up to 27 tons of lead would fall into the lake every year. And in the year 1985, 1986, there was a significant cleanup whereby 128 tons of accumulated lead pellets were dredged from the lake. This board's regulatory involvement began in 1994 when we issued site cleanup requirements to the city and to the club. The main requirement was that the club cease the use of lead shot and clay targets containing PAHs. And the good news is both goals were accomplished on time. The lead shot was replaced by steel in 1994, and new biodegradable clay targets without PAHs were phased in by the year 2000. What you see in the bottom here, I hope you can make it out, these orange objects are the new biodegradable clay targets. In 1995, shortly after the site cleanup requirements were issued, the State Department of Fish and Game determined that further cleanup of the lake to protect waterfowl was not needed. Thus, all the objectives of the 1994 order have now been completed, and this order can be rescinded. But the upland soils, a portion of which you see here, remain contaminated with PAHs, which is why we need to update this order at this time. The tentative order in front of you has two main goals. It requires additional cleanup of the upland soils to meet human health standards. It also requires an ecological risk assessment of the offshore lake sediments to see if there's any remaining impacts to benthic organisms, those organisms that live in and on the lake sediments, and if so, if additional lake cleanup would be required. During the public comment period, we received comments from both the San Francisco PUC, the city, and the Gun Club. And the comment letters are attached, as usual, as part of your agenda package. The city proposed modest changes, which we have in part accepted. And the city supports the revised order and our responses to their comments. The Gun Club, however, has requested a few changes to the order, which I'll quickly go through. First, they allege that the submerged areas of the site in Lake Merced, that this area is actually owned by the State Lands Commission, not the city, and therefore the commission should be added as a discharger. Secondly, they state that the order's CEQA findings do not disclose potential impacts from upcoming cleanup or remedial actions. Next, they challenge the proposed change to the order, which would have said that clay targets were found all throughout the site. And lastly, they also challenge the proposed change to the order, which would have said that there are no other sources of PAHs on the site save for the clay targets formerly used. We have responded to all these comments, and again, our response to comment is included, as usual, in your agenda package. As to the question of who owns the land at the site, the city has requested a title study from the State Lands Commission, but they indicate this will take several months to complete. So we don't have an answer yet, but at present, we have named the parties that are primarily responsible for the site contamination, the site operator, and the PUC, which will actively manage and clean up the site. You, the board, of course, have the discretion to add the State Lands Commission as discharger at a later date if it is shown that they are, in fact, an owner and if cleanup of the submerged or lake areas is, in fact, required. Also, it would be premature to conduct further CEQA analysis now, as the final cleanup plans are not yet determined. There simply is no project at the present time to analyze. But we are requiring the dischargers to comply before any cleanup starts. To allow additional time for compliance with CEQA, we recommend that the deadline for submission of the remedial plans for upland soil, which was originally stated to be October 1, 2013, be extended to July 1, 2014. We've run that past the city, and they are in concurrence. Lastly, we have also modified the tentative order per the club's comments as to the location of the clay targets and of the potential sources of PAHs at the site. Staff, therefore, recommend the adoption of the tentative order with the modified remedial plan deadline, as I just mentioned. And this is it for my presentation. I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you. Yes. Board Member McGrath.
I do have a question. The staff report included a large number of borings.
Correct.
And I can't tell from the quality of the reproduction of Exhibit C2 if those are all on land or any of them are submerged?
I believe all the ones that are submitted are on land. The attempt in showing this was to clarify that, by and large, clay targets, which also contained historically PAHs, were found primarily between the firing position and the lake, which is what you would expect. Lead shot being dense will go in one direction. The clay targets may fly around a bit, but pretty much it's going to be in the forward shooting position. And that, based on that, we clarified the finding and the order as to where the clay targets are located.
So with the Department of Fish and Game already, Fish and Wildlife, I guess they are now, already indicating that there's probably no impact, it's not also automatic that a risk assessment for the lake would entail new sampling in the lake. If the existing information about the fall off of materials from the point of discharge out to the ocean is sufficient, that could be sufficient to provide and support an ecological risk assessment?
Yes, that's entirely true. It should be noted that the Fish and Game's position was relatively narrow. They are looking at, was there sufficient lead shot readily available to diving ducks or other waterfowl? And they concluded not.
So it is possible, although not certain, that an ecological risk assessment could rely on existing information.
That is possible.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'd even highlight that in Task 4, we even say that, including analysis of existing sediment data. I will also note that, Al noted that we'll recommend change to Task 2 to change the compliance date to July 1, 2014 from October 1, 2013. We do have minor wording change to that Task 2 and to Task 6 relative to the consideration of compliance with CEQA. And Yuri has some language that we recommend adding at the end of both Task 2 and Task 6.
So, yeah, if you look on page 6 and on page 7, specifically tasks number 2 and number 6, the last sentence, it says that the discharger shall submit documentation demonstrating compliance with CEQA and the selection of the remedial action plan. I would like to add that the following clause, so that the executive officer may consider the environmental impacts of the remedy prior to approving a RAP, because the idea is that right now there is not a project, but, you know, once a remedial action plan does come before us and the executive officer has to approve that, we will be committing to a course of action that may have an impact on the environment. So it's very appropriate for the executive office to consider that CEQA document when approving the RAP. Does that make sense?
Understand?
Nope. Yeah, right. And may I ask legal counsel a quick question also on where's my mind going? Oh, do we have a any history of lands under lakes and reservoirs out there?
I specifically
kind of not a very
don't.
Good way to frame
yeah.
It,
I'm just
well, I think what
it.
You're asking is have we ever regulated lands owned by State Lands Commission, or ever named State Lands Commission. I'm not aware that we've had a need to name them. There certainly have been lands that we have been concerned about and had action on that they have owned. For instance, the mothball fleet, actually, that's state lands, and state lands had a lease with the Maritime Administration. They actually found in that case that when we were pursuing an action against the Maritime Administration, they were all for it, because even though their lease said that the operation would not pollute, they realized to enforce that lease they had to go back to Washington, D.C. to do that. And so I'm almost wondering in this case that potentially the gun club may be careful what they ask for, because if the State Lands Commission does get involved here, that there may be some questionable legal issues in terms of who does what that may make this cleanup very onerous, or more onerous than it appears to at the time.
Excuse me.
But if the question is, if do we have the legal authority to name State Lands Commission, the answer is yes, if it's appropriate.
Thank you. Any other further question with our staff at the moment?
I just one other question. Yes, sir. So I thought I read in counsel to the Rod and Gun Club letter that that they were contesting a tentative order. Are the changes that have been made to it that resulted in it now being on our uncontested calendar, or is it contested?
I think they requested to be contested. I think they have a remaining point, I believe, with respect to the State Lands Commission issue that they still wish to address.
So we do have a card from counsel for the Gun Club.
Just for my own lack of familiarity. So how does it get on our uncontested calendar when a discharger says that it's...
Well, initially we anticipate that we think we've addressed the issues, but in our response, if that doesn't address, it's certainly appropriate for them to request it be taken off. Historically, we found that it's potentially simpler procedurally to list something as uncontested if we think it's going to be, because then we can take it off without having any difficulty. But we can't go the other way. If we list something as contested and say, oh, now everybody agrees, we can't, after we put the agenda out, put it on the uncontested.
Okay, thank you.
So I think first we'll hear from the Council for Pacific Rod and Gun Club, and then we will go to City of San Francisco.
And that letter up there.
Have you handed them the letter already?
No, it's up on the screen.
Mr. Arnold, I don't know how.
I'm with the letter.
I can get out of this if you'd like.
Yeah, get out of that for me.
Mr. Arnold, I'm not quite sure how long your presentation is, but we'll try to do the best you can to keep it moving forward, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I don't know whether I should approach the board or the executive officer, but we have copies here of the...
Yeah, just give it to the staff, and then that way you could get started in your... We've decided to accept it.
Thank you.
It's not a new comment. It's something that's in the record, but it's in color, whereas the agenda did not show it in color.
Okay, so there's no major changes except the photography. Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
Well, let me proceed. I'm Jim Arnold. I'm legal counsel for the Pacific Rod and Gun Club. It's a nonprofit corporation that was incorporated in 1929. It's been operating out here at Lake Merced since the late 1930s. It's had a lease with the City and County of San Francisco for all these years. Recently, it shifted to a modern lease that has a two-year lease with a renewable feature in it. The club has participated for years in various studies activities having to do with what the use of the land around Lake Merced should be. The PUC has decided that the club is responsible for any lead or any pH contamination that may be found within the area of the club. The club occupies probably 10 acres. There's probably 14 acres plus some offshore lake bottom that has been affected by the activities of the club. As far as the order and what we're here for today, the one point that we have is that we really do believe that the State Lands Commission should be named as a discharger in this order. We think it will be more efficient and will result in a cleanup that an evaluation in the cleanup that would be an appropriate use of public funds. The one thing I wanted to point out at the beginning was in the tentative order itself, we say, just a minute here, that the purpose of this 13304 order is to both investigate and address the lead contamination, the pH contamination. that is a sort of a historical artifact. It's stated in the order on page 2, item 4, that the pellets from the historical activity, a significant percentage were deposited into the lake. It was probably about 27 tons per year. You can take the calculation based on how many years we're talking about, 80-some-odd years, and that there was a cleanup dredging effort in 1985-86 when the city went into the lake and attempted to extract lead pellets and larger fragments. That's 128 tons is what they eventually recovered. That activity itself causes the disbursement of smaller fragments and smaller amounts of lead into the lake and into the biosphere. I don't know at this point. We don't have anything in the record as to whether they had a permit from the State Lands Commission at the time. The State Lands Commission does assert jurisdiction over various kinds of structures in the lake. Our point is that the State Lands Commission should be named a discharger at this point in time so that we have a complete result that they participate in this to the extent they want to. They may very well decide that they can delegate their responsibilities to the City and County of San Francisco. That would be appropriate. However, we are concerned that both whatever investigation is done and the remedy that is selected have the participation, or at least the opportunity to participate, of anybody who is considered to be a discharger. And this board and the state board have shown no reluctance in the past under 13304 to name a current landowner as a discharger. Now, let me turn quickly to the facts that we have here. We've passed out a letter, and now I'm trying to move this. Alan, could you help me move this thing so we can get over to that little icon? I'm going to open up that icon there.
Which icon?
Oh, I should look over here. This one here.
This one here?
Yes, please. Okay.
We can go forward or back.
Yeah, well, we're page up. Okay. What we have put in front of you is a color copy of my letter of 30th of May. And in this letter, we talk about why it is that we think the State Lands Commission should be made and added to this order at this time as a discharger. And the reason that we point this out, or the facts that we have to present to you, is the first fact is a map from 1871 from the General Land Office, which shows the western boundary of the land grant running north-south through the lake, cutting through the lake. On the left-hand side, it says public. That means that's public lands, lands that were available for disposal by the federal government. You'll see there just above the word public a little bit of a notch in the lake. That's important to keep our eye on as we look at what we can see here. So that's a official survey. This second map is a map that back in 1988, the city and the State Lands Commission had some discussion about what the title might be or where the title might be in the lake. And you see there in handwriting, it says approximate boundary of the De La Merced Rancho. And you'll see on the left there a notch, which is actually a cove in the topography of the lake. On the left-hand side of the notch is the police range that's used by the City and County of San Francisco for their police department. On the right-hand side is the area that's been used by the Pacific Rod and Gun Club. Then we come down a little bit. There's another old map which shows how the rancho was a rectangular shape. I'm not sure this seems to be a line north-south, but well, it isn't really. But it does show there is some question about where the boundary is.
Now, is this the diseño that was the Mexican land grant for to the rancho?
Yes. Yes. And here we have another federal government map, which shows the left boundary, the west boundary of that rancho. Okay? And these things did not come through very well in black and white. Then we have a color photo here, which comes from the files of the consultant AMEC, a large consulting firm that has been studying the lake. And if you look just up there a little bit to the left, you'll see the sort of a white spot. Well, first you'll see a notch just under the white writing. That's that cove that we saw on the other map. And then just to the left of that, or up the shore, is where the police range is. So using those as guides, and then using some of the features of the lake, the north part of the lake and the south part of the lake, we approximated a red line there as to what the west side, the west boundary of what the city actually has title to. Now, what is this all about? Well, the city has title to, as a successor in interest to, the original Mexican land grant. The land under the lake passed with the Mexican land grant, passed to the Spring Valley Water Company, and then passed to the city. The land to the left of that line, though, was public lands of the United States before it was patented out after statehood. So the bottom of the lake on the left-hand side of the line belongs to the state of California. Okay? So that's what we say it shows.
Can you go back to Exhibit D?
Please, yes.
Where it says plat. This was the confirmation by the district court as part of the realization of Mexican land grants under the
treaty? I believe it was. We have a logo there that talks about it being 1867, I believe that is.
Yeah, it says confirmed.
Yeah.
So this is the Desenio as confirmed by the U.S. courts?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
So we have that. Then we, as I said, we have the aerial photo. Okay, we see what we see here, right? And let's orient ourselves a little bit. Down at the bottom there, where the red line hits the south boundary of the lake, first it crosses the area that the Rod and Gun Club occupies and uses and has used for many, many years. Then it crosses John Muir Drive. Okay? So, and it also, there's an apartment complex there. So correlating these maps and diagrams and things, this is what we've come to. Okay? Now, we look at the next photo. This is the photo that you've already seen. This was a photo presented by the club to the PUC. It shows where the ranges are. This is oriented. The other one was oriented 90 degrees to the left. This one comes from the south. Is on the north. Is on the top part there where the apartment houses are. There's John Muir Drive, and then there's the club. It shows the entire spread of the club. And the ranges, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. 7, by the way, is an Olympic skeet range that we have for our Olympic training. And 8, those are all ranges that have been used for years and years and years, from which lead has been shot southward, or downward, not southward, but downward over towards the lake, and also from where the targets, both the old asphaltic type targets from pre-2000 and then the orange sort of day glow, I guess modern, 70s version of targets, whatever. But anyway, they're day glow biodegradable targets. And I should also mention that when shooting takes place out here, there's actually an exclusion zone that's set out in the lake with buoys so that the rowing teams, for instance, from SI or USF or whatever, can stay away from this particular area. Now, the club only uses the...
Good choice.
Yeah, only uses the property 3 days a week, Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. So, bottom line is the State Lands Commission should be named as a discharger here because the State Lands Commission is the owner for the state of the land which has been impacted and should be part of the process of deciding what kind of a study should be done, what is the proper remediation, et cetera. And this is important to the club for several reasons. Number one, this is a volunteer organization, okay? So it's not a publicly funded entity. The members of the club, there are about 350 members, They do have a concern about what ratepayers have to pay. They have a concern about what taxpayers have to pay. And they're also concerned about whether there, you know, might be other sources of funds that would be available to contribute to this situation that they find themselves in. Well, it's pretty clear that if the state lands has made a discharger on this, that the lead and the PAHs have fallen onto lands of another. They didn't fall onto lands necessarily was leased or occupied by the club. They didn't fall on lands that was leased by the city to the club. They fell on a third party's lands. And this in and of itself can be very, very significant as far as where the financial end of this thing actually goes. Okay. Now, I'll also point out to you and explain that we and the PUC have worked extensively with the staff at the board in order to develop this order. And we have found everybody to be receptive. We just have this one point that we have asked for, that a finding be made and that perhaps the executive officer could be the person with the authority to designate the State Lands Commission if the board wants to wait until such time as there's more title evidence on the record as far as the State Lands Commission owning the area where the discharges actually occurred and owning the area that's underneath the water of the lake. That's essentially where our position is today.
We got the
thank
point
you.
There.
Just one quick, just for me to understand. Is your point that only as to the land beneath the lake surface, or are you suggesting that the city of San Francisco doesn't own the land that the gun club leases?
No, the city of San Francisco does own the land that the gun club is sitting on, where those ranges are actually sitting, the physical dry land that's flat, okay? There's some question about how far up the boundary of the lake extends.
But your point is only as to the bottom of the lake.
But it's only the bed of the lake that is owned by the State Lands Commission.
To the west of that line.
Right.
To the west of that line, which is, as you can see, is from that approximation there, is most of the club and, you know, 7 out of the 9 firing ranges.
What?
With 28 tons of lead going into the lake since the 1930s.
Are you trying to construct a theory? I mean, I think you make a case that it was ungranted land in the original decennio and its confirmation, and therefore becomes public land, and the State Lands Commission may have an interest in it. But I'm not sure how it matters. Do you think that they should be a potentially responsible party for somebody shooting into their property? I mean, I don't know the benefit. I don't know where that argument takes you in terms of benefit.
Well, I think it takes us all someplace where there is a benefit. Okay, Section 13304 says a person is liable if they allow a nuisance to continue. Okay, and the board has used this many times to get landowners who had no actual activity, no physical activity with regard to land that's been impacted, number one. Number two, another section of the code, of the water code.
Stay with the microphone,
cited,
please.
I'm sorry. Another section of the water code, which isn't cited here, does ask the board, require the board to encourage responsible party participation in what the activity is that is done. And what I'm saying is that we don't know where this is going at this point, but if the board's going to take the serious step of reissuing a 13304 order, it's a very good idea to include the other property owner, okay, in this. Because we could very well head in some direction and we wind up in the wrong place.
Through the chair, if I may just respond Mr. Arnold's points. Okay, so with respect to the State Lands Commission, I think it's unsettled as to who owns the bed of the lake. That will be decided or determined at some future point. That not having that information does not preclude the board from proceeding with this cleanup order. The State Board Resolution 9249, which is a resolution that directs cleanup, makes it clear that the board can issue a cleanup order without having identified every single party. And number three, I think we have a serious due process problem if we proceed to name State Lands Commission to this order when they are not, they don't have notice of this proceeding, they are not a party to this proceeding, so I would suggest that you consider that.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Next will be, I need you to conclude, please, given you well over 10 minutes.
So. Just one other point, Your Honor.
Final comment.
Mr. Chairman, is that simply we would like to, if we need to get notice to the State Lands Commission, you know, our suggestion would be just simply continue us to the next meeting and get this taken care of.
That's fine. Thank you,
thank
sir.
You.
So we'll go with our Deputy City Attorney for SFPUC, Mr. Milty. Thank you. And we have one more card after that, Gary.
Chair Miller, members of the board, I'm Josh Milstein from the San Francisco City Attorney's Office. I'm here on behalf of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and I'm under oath. I just wanted to be brief. The city is interested in cleaning up this property as quickly as possible. I think Board Member McGrath and Executive Officer Wolf's comments that questioning the merits of bringing in the State Lands Commission at this time are well taken. We don't know the shoreward extent of the state's ownership, assuming ownership. And as Mr. Friedman pointed out, at this point, there's no evidence to conclude that the state's been damaged or harmed or that a nuisance has been created in the submerged lands. So on that basis, we support the order as written and urge its adoption.
Thank you. May I ask you, it seems like they're like on a two-year lease now. Are they into the two-year lease pretty deep, or is it just beginning, or what's the situation?
We filed an unlawful detainer action against the club, and they've agreed to a stipulated judgment that allows the city to terminate up to a two-year lease on 90 days' notice and to secure a court order to evict them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your associate like to make some comments here?
He's an interested stakeholder, but
Josh is going to take exception to being associate. We know each other quite well. My name is Jerry Cadigan. I am co-founder of an organization called the Committee to Save Lake Merced. I've been working on Lake Merced issues as a volunteer since before your 1994 order that started this particular proceeding, the cleanup problem. I initially got involved because of the water level problem. My daughter rode there. She's now, as a high schooler, she's now 35 years old. So Lake Merced and I know each other very well, and I just can't extract myself. I'm coming here today for one specific reason. I would like you to do whatever can be done, and I am a recovering lawyer, but I know nothing about the procedures. Whatever can be done to expedite this whole procedure. As I just said, I acknowledge, this has been going on with you people since 1994, when Steve Ritchie was sitting in that chair over there, what have you. And it just seems to me that we've got to get on with it and get that place cleaned up or covered up or whatever's going to happen. Now, there's a very specific reason that I want to expedite things, other than the fact that I'm getting old. And that is that last year, the voters in San Francisco passed a $195 park bond, $195 million park bond. $2 million was allocated to Lake Merced improvements. The most needed improvement at Lake Merced is a new boathouse for the rowers. The obvious location for that new boathouse, and I know the Pacific Rod and Gun Club don't want to hear this, but it's just 1 acre at the far eastern end of that property. And if this goes on and drags on to 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, that $2 million is going to get frittered away somewhere else. That is my only concern. I could go on for two or three days here about other Lake Merced issues, but we've got to get that place cleaned up and put that property to good use. And the best use of just probably 1 acre at the far eastern end is a site for a new boathouse. You've got a great boathouse here in Oakland. You've got a great boathouse up there in Marin County. There's a great boathouse in Sacramento. San Francisco doesn't have a decent boathouse. They've got basically a basement of a crummy old building, what have you. So I'm here to ask, please expedite this to the extent humanly possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And staff, may I ask you then, in our history, most of the Lake Merced water is a natural body, correct? It comes from subsurface,
yes,
and yeah. And also, does it receive any storm
water? Can you go to the podium, please?
Excuse me.
There is, actually, yes. I'll plug in. There is some runoff. Predominantly, most of the storm drainage goes into the city's combined system, which means it ends up in the wastewater treatment plant. But there is some still remaining runoff that gets in from around the sides and the south end. In fact, we're working with the city of Daly City on a project that would potentially augment the lake with some of the runoff from Daly City, bringing it into the south end.
So in simple terms, water does flow over the historical targets that are on the shore bank.
In the area where the gun club is, there is some level of natural runoff close to the shore that does get into the lake.
Thank you. Board members? Board Member McGrath?
Well, I just as a terminal nerd, I who's been exposed to this, there's an interesting little piece, but I'm not sure it matters. Many years ago, I worked on Sea Drift, which was a similar case where a Mexican land grant covered by a decenio had been patented in U.S. courts after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And those lands that are not patented through the courts are, in fact, ungranted land subject to the federal government. Whether or not that the bed includes state lands or it was given as a piece of property, there are unresolved title issues that remain 150 years after California, 160 years or whatever after California became a state. So it's interesting, and there's an interesting argument that's been made that has, I think, some credence that perhaps this is state lands, but perhaps it's also been granted as part of the other land. I'm not at all convinced that it matters, both because it's not absolutely clear that further dredging is required. And I find the argument that the state lands on something where the tidal path is kind of arcane and unresolved might have allowed a nuisance to occur and therefore be liable rather than the people who discharged the waste in the first place. I mean, that's a fairly arcane argument that I don't find either persuasive to begin with or requiring us to act, because what's mostly involved here is the cleanup of the fast lands, the dry lands, and a risk assessment. And should the Rod and Gun Club follow the title on the left hand and determine that the fast lands pass to San Francisco, I imagine, but not the lake bottom, and there's a huge amount and there's a case, then I think they're free to pursue that on their own. I don't know that charging the State Lands Commission for the discharge of the Rod and Gun Club, because they may have title to it, is a very fruitful. But it's certainly not something that affects whether or not I think we should act at this stage. So I'm going to support the staff recommendation, although I just felt compelled to say there's an interesting question here. It's been raised well. And it may be true, but I don't think it matters to the question of getting on with the cleanup.
Although you did prejudge the staff recommendation.
It's great to have a historian sitting up here. Yes, Vice Chair.
I just want to clarify a couple of things on the timeline. I think, Yuri, it may have been you who said that we expected to find out within a couple of or 3 weeks, like within a month, whether the state lands actually does own the sediment bed.
My understanding is that from the comment letters is that there is San Francisco is undergoing a title search, mm-hmm. but San Francisco can come up and verify that.
What I'm trying to get at is if the – and he's a fast walker. I'll let him answer that.
Josh Milstein again. You know, we have the 1988 title report from the state, and I'm not sure how much more title work is necessary. Spring Valley Water Company did claim ownership of the bed of the entire lake, but there doesn't appear to be a – record to support the claim to this area outside the Rancho boundary. But as Board Member McGrath states, I'm not sure how relevant that is. The city has substantial experience cleaning up gun clubs with the Peninsula Sportsman's Club, fully intends to clean up this site, subject to comments on the board's treatment of the studies that we submit. And we certainly, at this point, don't have any evidence to support going after the state of California for any of those cleanup costs. So I'm inclined to think that it would just slow things down and complicate things to name the state at this time.
All right. Thank you. Where I was going with this is that it seems to me that the schedule for the task list would allow us to react to any finding that the State Lands Commission should be involved in a timely manner before implementation started, and perhaps even before the remedial action plan was designed. So
I would agree with that, because essentially, as I think you understand, there's two aspects here: tasks specific to the upland area, which is not in question, and tasks specific to the lake sediments. And the tasks specific to the lake sediments 4, 5, 6, and 7 on page 7, initially it would be a work plan for ecological risk assessment within approximately 6 months, do the ecological risk assessment by October 1, 2014, and if and only if the risk assessment determines that remedial action is necessary, then it would be up to my request to request submittal of a remedial action plan. All of this involves some level of step down, as it were. There's opportunities, certainly, should it be appropriate to return and request naming state lands as a responsible party, we would have the ability to do so. But on the flip side, I would say there's no reason that we should hold up adoption of this order, especially relative to the upland tasks and the initial development of a plan for ecological risk assessment, while we wait for some determination on title, which may never come.
Thank you.
Any further comments? Recommendations?
So to sum up, just spelling out that I do not see any benefit, water quality benefit, by slowing adoption of this order and slowing implementation of the tasks as spelled out in the order. I struck, in fact, you can still see it up there as part of the issue here. The little line says approximate western boundary. You know, there's a lot of gray area in this whole issue, and it certainly, as I say, may be something that may never come to some full resolution, and there's no benefit of slowing implementation of the tasks while we wait for something that may never come to fruition. So based on that, I would recommend adoption of the tentative order with the changes to tasks 2 and 6, the wording that Yuri read, and the date in task 2, changing the compliance date from October 1, 2013 to July 1st, 2014. We recognize that was overly ambitious to say that we would expect the dischargers to have demonstrated compliance with CEQA in selection of the remedial action plan by October 1. That was unrealistic. So with those changes, I'd recommend adoption.
Okay. I would go ahead and ask.
Is it appropriate to move approval?
In your microphone.
I move approval of the staff recommendation.
I'll second.
It's been moved and second. In discussion purposes, again, we are put in these positions to, again, make tough decisions. And we have to make these decisions to do the right thing for the environment. And whether we shut Skeet out there in our
past history, who knows? Probably some of us have. But the idea is now it's time we have to move forward. And this is actually a wonder of the world out there. And San Francisco PUC has been doing its more than fair share, in my opinion, to try to get this straightened up. And I know it's very difficult for the 350 members that have long legacy history out there. But in my opinion, we do have to start this trying to clean up history. Again, as I stated today early, but in our role, we have to make that decision. And I hope in the future boards won't be cleaning up history that we've already taken care of some of the issues. But
won't be cleaning up our messes.
Yeah, try not to clean up our messes. So roll call vote, please.
Aye.
Board Member McGrath?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
Chair Mueller?
Aye. Four ayes. The item is passed. And so we're, again, pinched for time here, but we will move to the shoreline study quickly.
Well, I would recommend we do, before that, the groundwater awareness item. We continued that from last month.
I know.
I will note that we will be continuing to, for future months, the Item 8 Land Disposal Program Update and Item 10 Arambrew Island Restoration Project. But I would request that we hold forth and try to address both Items 7 and 9.
The groundwater awareness, we appreciate it, and we'll try to breeze through it as quickly as possible if we can, because at least we can take this home with us. Thank you. I think so. Okay.
Good morning by 5 minutes, Chairman Mueller and board members. My name is Mary Rose Cassa. I'm an engineering geologist in the Toxics Cleanup Division. Today, Alec Noggle and I will share with you the importance of groundwater in this region.
Actually, you know, it's quite appropriate you're presenting this after our last two items here.
Yeah.
Several staff contributed to this report, including Cleet Carlton, Agnes Farris, Alex Karpowitz, Laurent Millier, and Marcia Succardi. I'll begin the presentation with some context and an overview of groundwater in our region, and Alec will conclude with specifics about groundwater use, basin impairments and threats, and finally a discussion of priorities. It requires active management to protect groundwater supplies and beneficial uses and to deal with the extreme pressures from population growth. Because groundwater is not something we see every day, the public can benefit from an occasional gentle reminder to appreciate and protect this fragile resource. 10 years ago, in 2003, Assembly Concurrent Resolution No. 99 declared May as Groundwater Awareness Month. This was an important statewide tool to accomplish the goal of reminding the public about the importance of groundwater. Groundwater is a precious natural resource, but it is in the classic position of out of sight, out of mind. This slide shows some examples of groundwater daylighting in the region, rare cases where groundwater is not out of sight, out of mind. These examples happen to be from San Francisco. You just saw an example, Lake Merced, which is fed by groundwater. The large photo on this slide is of El Poblan Spring in the Presidio. The spring was used by Native Americans before Europeans arrived and settled San Francisco. The towhee bird in the lower left demonstrates that the spring is also important for supporting ecological beneficial uses. In the lower right is a photo of Mountain Lake, another groundwater-fed surface water body in western San Francisco. This diagram depicts the various pathways of water in the hydrologic cycle. I won't go into all the details of the diagram, but I'll point out some key elements. Evaporation from the ocean is the primary source of water in the atmosphere. As water vapor moves over the land, it returns to the Earth's surface as precipitation and flows overland or infiltrates into the ground. driven by gravity, the infiltrated water moves through the ground. The light blue stippled pattern in the lower right of the block diagram represents the zone where all the interconnected openings between sediment particles are filled with water. This is the saturated zone to which the term groundwater applies. Supply wells tap this resource for drinking water, industrial supply, and irrigation. Groundwater can also emerge in streams or lakes as a surface expression of the water table, the top of the saturated zone. Much of California's groundwater occurs in buried stream deposits called alluvium. Coarse-grained sand and gravel deposits form aquifers and are the best source of water. Finer-grained clay and silt deposits are poor sources of water and can inhibit or retard groundwater flow. These layers, referred to as aquitards, can also help protect deeper aquifers from contamination in shallow aquifers. The Water Board's Basin Plan describes the designated beneficial uses for groundwater in the region, the water quality objectives necessary to protect those beneficial uses, and the implementation plan to maintain and achieve the objectives. Existing and potential beneficial uses applicable to groundwater in the region include municipal, domestic, industrial, and agricultural supply, groundwater recharge, and freshwater replenishment to surface waters. The Water Board's 1989 source water policy states that almost all of this region's groundwater is considered an existing or potential source of drinking water. The technical bases of the region's water quality objectives include information reported in the scientific literature, national water quality criteria, studies conducted by other agencies, and information gained from local environmental and discharge monitoring. In addition, feasibility in terms of technological, institutional, economic, and administrative factors is considered. The primary groundwater implementation plan activities for this region include updating beneficial uses and groundwater and water quality objectives for each groundwater basin, restoring groundwater by regulating activities that impact or have the potential to impact beneficial uses, and protecting groundwater by preventing future impacts through local and regional planning, management, and education. Now, Alec will take over, beginning with a discussion of groundwater use in the region.
All right. Good morning, Chair Mueller and members of the board. My name is Alec Noggle. I am an engineering geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division. The San Francisco Bay region is a fairly compact and urbanized region with about a population of 7 million, and groundwater supplies about 20% of the region's total water supply, and that's primarily for urban, residential, and agricultural uses. Most of the groundwater is pumped from large diameter water supply wells with a lesser contribution from smaller private domestic and irrigation wells. The percentage of groundwater use in the region will increase during drought years. There are 28 groundwater basins within our region, and most of the groundwater use occurs in the 8 basins that are shown on this figure in pink. These include the Napa, Sonoma, and Petaluma Valleys in the North Bay, the Clayton Valley and the Livermore-Amador Valley in the East Bay, the Niles Cone in the Fremont area, the Santa Clara Valley in the South Bay, and the Peninsula's West Side Basin that serves Daly City and San Bruno. At the same time, the smaller basins of the Half Moon Bay Terrace and the Pescadero Valley, which are shown in blue on this figure, are heavily relied upon for community supply by the communities in those basins. But the total volume in those smaller basins is much less when compared to the other 8 basins highlighted in pink. Some of the basins, such as the Santa Clara Valley, the Livermore-Amador Valley, the Niles Cone, these are actively managed to replenish groundwater supply. The primary sources of groundwater degradation in the region include industrial chemicals, which are largely addressed through the Water Board's cleanup programs and the land disposal program, salts and seawater intrusion, which is largely addressed by local groundwater management agencies like the Alameda County Water District, nitrates from agricultural use and wastewater disposal, in areas such as the Pescadero Valley and the Livermore Valleys. Boron and arsenic, which are naturally occurring constituents associated with volcanic rocks, such as in the Napa and Sonoma valleys. We currently oversee about 1,100 sites with confirmed releases of industrial chemicals that have polluted or threatened to pollute groundwater. This does not include the landfills or the salt and nutrient impacts. All of these sites are regulated by our site cleanup program, our underground storage tank program, or our Department of Defense cleanup program. We approve site-specific soil and groundwater cleanup concentrations to protect beneficial uses and public health. The Groundwater Ambient Monitoring and Assessment Program, referred to as GAMA, was created by the State Water Board in 2000, and this was largely in response to concerns about groundwater quality and public supply well closures associated with the gasoline additive MTBE, plus industrial solvents and perchlorate. GAMA involves sampling community, municipal, and agricultural supply wells for a variety of contaminants using ultra-low detection limits. The goal is to provide a baseline water quality data from the deeper aquifers in our basins, and this is typically from depths greater than about 100 to 200 feet deep, which is the minimum depth that most water supply wells draw from. The State Board collaborates with the United States Geologic Survey and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory to implement the GAMA program. The State Board identified priority groundwater basins based on use of groundwater and the perceived vulnerability of those basins to urban, industrial, and agricultural pollution sources. The program has already sampled the highest use basins in the region that you saw earlier, and it's designed to resample these basins approximately every 10 years, depending upon program funding. Another feature of GAMA is the GeoTracker GAMA database, which is shown in this screenshot. GeoTracker GAMA combines the cleanup information from our cleanup programs, which is housed in the GeoTracker database, with the GAMA results for the supply wells. So a user can create a map like the one you're looking at here that shows the cleanup sites and the supply wells for a particular groundwater basin. In this example, the results are for the gasoline additive MTBE in the Santa Clara Valley. The triangles are cleanup sites. The circles and squares are supply wells. The red, yellow, and green coloring indicates the contaminant concentration with respect to the drinking water standard. Now, by clicking on links in the table at the bottom of this figure, you can get more information if you'd like about the specific cleanup sites, the triangles, or specific water supply wells. This map shows groundwater impacts in the region from the chemical perchloroethylene, otherwise known as PCE. PCE is a chlorinated solvent associated mainly with dry cleaners and is one of the most common solvents detected in groundwater statewide. This particular map combines historic and current PCE detections in water supply wells, and that goes back to the time when data was first collected in the early 1980s. So it's really a worst-case snapshot that you're looking at here. Again, the round dots are agricultural and irrigation supply wells. The square dots are drinking water supply wells. The dots with circles indicate a well cluster, which means that they represent two or more supply wells that are located close to each other. At this regional scale, just about every dot or square represents a well cluster. In all, there are nearly 1,200 water supply wells represented on this figure. The colors from green to red indicate relative concentration with respect to the drinking water standard, which is known as the maximum contaminant level, or MCL. The red means that one or more of the supply wells in the cluster had exceeded the drinking water standard for PCE at some time since the beginning the data was collected in 1980. The good news is that only about 1% of the nearly 1,200 water supply wells in our region have or had ever had impacts above the drinking water standard for PCE. The not-so-good news is that that equates to 11 water supply wells that had to either be treated or blended or removed from service because of these impacts. Now, this map is the same map you were just looking at, except it shows the impacts for just the past 10 years. The most noticeable thing is that there are fewer red exceedances. Some of that may be due to supply wells being taken out of service, but some is undoubtedly due to the success of our cleanup programs to find and address PCE sources such as dry cleaners. So let me just toggle back and forth a couple times so you can see the changes. For example, note the fewer overall red exceedances in the past 10 years and also a change from red to yellow in the San Jose well cluster. Okay, so here's the previous slide showing the historic data set. Here's the last 10 years. Again, the combined data for all time and what we think is the more representative figure for just the last 10 years. Global warming is an issue we've all heard about. The effects of global warming can threaten supply and beneficial uses for both surface water and groundwater in this region and statewide. Global warming breaks down into two components, sea level rise and climate change. Each has implications for groundwater resources in this region. First, even a modest rise in sea level can cause the water table to rise near the bay margin, and this can potentially cause a groundwater plume to change direction, or it can mobilize soil contaminants that are dissolving into the groundwater. To address this, we require cleanup actions and set cleanup standards that consider plume stability and contaminant leachability from soil sources. At the same time, sea level rise can cause seawater intrusion into deep aquifers near the shoreline. The Alameda County Water District already combats this by maintaining groundwater levels above sea level. This keeps fresh water flowing outward to the bay rather than salty bay water flowing inward to the aquifer. Other areas at risk of seawater intrusion could include the Napa and the Sonoma and Petaluma basins where there is little active groundwater level management. Second, a shift in climate can lead to a greater need for storing water in underground aquifers. This comes about due to the combined effects of greater water demands in the drier, warmer summer and more rainfall but less snowpack in the winter. To capture this winter runoff that would otherwise be bound in the snowpack, water agencies are considering enhanced groundwater storage projects. The State Board is drafting a groundwater strategic work plan to bring attention and secure future funding to these three statewide priorities. In the next slides, I'll discuss how each priority is being addressed, and I should mention that State Board, I believe, intends to complete this work plan in this year, 2013. The first priority is addressing groundwater quality degradation due to pollutant discharges, such as the industrial chemicals, the salts and nitrates, as you saw earlier. To address this priority, the water boards regulate site cleanup and issue cleanup orders to remediate groundwater quality impacted by pollution. For example, the site cleanup program. We also prescribe waste discharge requirements for landfills, dredge disposal, and other discharge activities. And at the same time, the water boards are working with local agencies to develop salt and nutrient groundwater management plans pursuant to the State Water Board's recycled water policy. The second priority is reducing groundwater overpumping that is caused by a lack of effective coordination and management. Overpumping can lead to a host of problems, including the spread of contaminant plumes, lowered water tables, and seawater intrusion. To address this priority, the California Water Code encourages local groundwater management planning. The plans address coordination among groundwater users and also monitoring to detect the effects of overpumping. At the same time, the State Board's recycled water policy has set goals for the use of recycled water to offset the needs of pumping. In this region, imported surface water and recycled water are already being used instead of groundwater to irrigate golf courses and cemeteries. The recycled water policy also foresees the need for future recharge projects using surface water, recycled water, and even stormwater. The third priority is enhancing stormwater percolation and groundwater recharge. In urban areas, impervious surfaces and hardscaping have reduced rainfall percolation to groundwater. To address this priority, urban planners and building designers are using the concept of low-impact development to minimize runoff while increasing percolation and recharge to the groundwater. Some examples include on-site water retention, the use of grassy swales, and porous pavement, as shown in this photo. These practices have the added benefit of reducing stream channelization and stormwater pollutants. Groundwater sustainability is the idea that groundwater resources should be used in the present without compromising our ability to meet the needs of the future. So we have long recognized that sustainability is the key to ensuring that there is an adequate supply of high-quality groundwater for the state. As this picture illustrates, groundwater sustainability may be described as a wheel with the spokes that represent the integration of societal needs with the desires and the desires with the principles of good science, engineering, and regulation. So, in conclusion, substantial challenges lie ahead in order to protect and manage and sustain the region's groundwater resources. For the past 30 years, this water board has been very active and diligent in protecting and restoring beneficial uses of groundwater in our region. And we expect that, with your support, the staff will continue to find creative ways to ensure the future of this precious resources. So this photo was taken in 2002, and it shows children playing with water from a hand-pumped well in the village of Yunnan Province, China. It also shows what we believe is that water can be both not only beneficial, but a fun resource. So that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair.
I have three quick questions. Number one, do we have any current examples in our region of overpumping?
Sorry, could you?
I'm curious to know whether we have examples in our region of overpumping of the type that we hear of in the Central Valley where the land collapses.
We have historic examples, and probably one of the first ones that comes to mind was the purpose of the creation of the Santa Clara Valley Water District. Is that at a time 70 or 80 years ago, 50 years ago, there was much overpumping for agricultural purposes.
But as far as we know now, things are more in balance?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
The Alviso area is essentially below sea level because that North San Jose area was overpumped back in the day.
So. Okay. Do we have any adjudicated basins?
No, I don't believe so.
San Gregorio Creek, I think is adjudicated.
Okay.
I believe so.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was San Gregorio. Oh,
yeah.
That's an adjudicated.
Okay.
And without the rain this year, it's going to be so dry.
You know. Okay. And third, how do we rank in terms, in comparison with the other regions, in our progressive implementation of LID, low-impact development? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know we're in a race with L.A., but what's happening in the rest of the state? Are we kind of ahead of the curve or behind the curve?
Well, these may not be our experts on that level.
Or do you have to take
level.
The fifth?
But I'd say that we feel we've been moving forward. The big challenge is to make this connection between the benefits of LID in overland flow, but also the benefits to groundwater recharge. And historically, in fact, some of our regulations have tried to minimize the use of or protect against groundwater recharge, recognizing that there is that pollution issue. But that's the ongoing challenge, is where are the opportunities? It's easier to pump it out than to put it back in. So that's the ongoing challenge, and that's where we see the opportunity to pull in LID practices to benefit not only all water use and sustainability, but especially groundwater sustainability.
Can I add something to that? In terms of where we stand relative to the rest of the state on that issue, our staff did start a group that's called the Groundwater Surface Water Interaction Work Group, and we got interest expressed from other regions. We don't know that they've done the same thing. And so one of the things we had in mind was the infiltration, the stormwater infiltration concept. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Nice presentation.
Thank you. I know of the new construction going on right now in our city that the new structure is building a huge pit next to it with, I don't know if it's legal or not, but he is loading it with drain rock, and all his drains will be draining into that pit because he doesn't have a stormwater. And that's sort of a recharging thing, but it's quite costly. I mean, you know, it's a French drain kind of situation,
right,
but on a bigger scale.
The challenge, obviously, is certainly there's benefits in flow attenuation from the runoff, but also you don't want to necessarily use that as a conduit to put polluted water into your groundwater. And so it's trying to get a balance, and that's where a lot of these LID processes include some level of most commonly natural treatment, but try not to have a direct conduit, have it more filtered.
Yeah, so it's not coming off the streets or anything. It's coming off of his new big barn, going right into his storm drain, but goes into the ground, which I found kind of interesting.
Right, and it's probably also a little self-serving because hopefully that supplies his own groundwater.
Yeah, eventually. So, very good. Thank you. And item 9, I can tell you I am not going to be able to make upstairs today.
Okay.
Just our driver manager's graduation, and I do know I will be driving back to San Francisco a couple times this afternoon, which is okay. But we're going to move on to our next presenter. Thank you guys for your patience.
So item 9 is a report on the South Bay Shoreline Study, and we have the eminent experts on this. John Bourgeois is the executive director of the South Bay Restoration Project, South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project, and Ann Morkill is the head of the San Francisco Bay Wildlife Refuge.
She has a badge and everything on.
So, yeah.
Some of them have guns, you know.
No badges.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Chair Muller, and thank you, Board. While we're trying to get the lights down, I'll do a quick introduction. My name is John Bourgeois. I work with the State Coastal Conservancy, and I'm the Executive Project Manager for the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project. And I'd like to introduce my colleague, Ann Morkill. Some of you may remember her predecessor, Mendel Stewart, who's now up in D.C. and is the new project leader for the 7 wildlife refuges in the area, and she's been a very welcome addition to our team. So you might be wondering why the restoration guy is talking to you about a flood control project. But that is actually one of the goals of the project. We have 3 main goals, habitat restoration being the first one, but also flood risk management, as well as public access and recreation. And so I've got a brief presentation, and I know I'm standing between everyone and lunch, so I'll try and make this quick. There seems to be, more and more often we're seeing images like this come up these days with these big storms and these terrible flooding events. But we seem to have a short memory, and we seem to think like this is always going to occur someplace else, when in fact we are very much at risk for this same sort of event. This was an image that was in the New York Times. It became one of the kind of iconic images coming after Hurricane Sandy. And this was one of their proposed solutions to storm surge in Manhattan, is to buy up all the waterfront property and create wetlands there. And although I think it's a great idea, I don't know who's going to foot that bill. However, for Silicon Valley, it's a completely different story. We actually have the ability to do just that. All of the salt ponds that surround Silicon Valley and the south end of the bay, the majority of them are in public ownership for the sole purposes of restoration. However, those same salt ponds have been providing some certain level of tidal flood protection. And so as we want to restore them and breach those levees and take away those levees to restore all the natural processes, the sedimentation and the marsh building, we're actually removing a certain level of flood protection. So the restoration project has to move forward very carefully to make sure we don't take any actions that put people at risk. And so that's why our project management team actually includes some of the local flood control agencies and the Corps of Engineers. And that's exactly how we're proceeding in Santa Clara County, because not only are homes and lives at risk, but also the economic engine of the area, Silicon Valley. You might recognize some of these names, all of which are in the 100-year floodplain, either currently or with the projections of sea level rise. So there are significant reasons to protect these areas besides the obvious. And there are lots of ways to move forward with flood protection. When you see the camouflage, you know that means we're moving forward with the Army Corps of Engineers. So we've embarked upon the South San Francisco Bay Shoreline Study with the Corps of Engineers. The non-federal sponsors include my agency, the State Coastal Conservancy, and on the local level, the Santa Clara Valley Water District. So those are the three partners that have been moving forward with this study. And the first thing the federal government needs to do is decide whether or not there is a federal interest in doing a project. And so they have divided Santa Clara County up into these divisions. It's basically from creek to creek to creek to creek. They divided the county shoreline up into these segments. And they call them EIAs, and that is for economic impact areas. And basically what they're doing is a cost-benefit assessment. Is there enough damage from potential flood to warrant doing a large flood control project? And there were several that kind of rose to the top. When we did this assessment, we looked at several levels of sea level rise. It's core policy that they have to examine the historic rate, which doesn't really make a lot of sense, but that's their policy. Everyone knows that that's not going to be the long-term rate of sea level rise. And then we kind of looked at the low end of the NRC curves and the high end of the NRC curves. And these numbers might not look familiar to you if you're familiar with these curves. It's because our time period, we were anticipating construction start in 2017, and so we've projected forward to 2067. So most of the numbers you're familiar with are either at 2050 or 2100. And so that's why these numbers might look a little odd to you, because they're at 2067, which is the end of the study period. And so this is what the flood assessment looks like. You can see these blue areas. Let me get the mouse here. You can see these areas of flooding under different, you know, they ran these models under different scenarios to look at the areas that were flooding to see where the most economic impact occurred. And a few came to the top. One of them was Palo Alto. And you can see this is mostly residential structures here that were flooding. The Sunnyvale area, this is
but
the
not Stanford.
Not Stanford, no.
Because it's of low economic value?
Brutal.
Wow, tough crowd. The other area was Sunnyvale. We've got a lot of the Moffett Field area that, you know, we've got Lockheed Martin and Yahoo, but we've also got some residential areas in that vicinity. And then the community of Alviso, which that was the image I showed earlier in the presentation, which is notably below sea level. We've also got the water pollution control plant in this area, which is, you know, sewage treatment for 1.4 million people. So if that goes underwater, that has significant implications as well. So these were the areas that kind of rose to the top. And the non-federal sponsors, because of the time and cost that it had taken to even get to this point, the non-federal sponsors pushed really hard for the Corps of Engineers to pick one and focus on that instead of trying to do the entire Santa Clara shoreline in one big, massive project. And so after much deliberation, this Area 11 in San Jose was actually selected as the area to move forward with. And so this is basically the area between the Guadalupe River and Coyote Creek, which is just off the map here. So there are already flood control projects, fluvial flood control projects on the Guadalupe River and Coyote Creek. So there are high points there. So basically, our job was to connect those high points with a tidal protection levee. And these are the sorts of alternatives we started to look at. And this is a narrowing down of the range of alternatives we looked at as for the location of a flood control levee. But like I said, so here's the community of Alviso. Here's the water pollution control plant here. This is the Guad River / Alviso Slough. So there's high points on this levee, and there's Coyote Creek here, and so this levee is protected. So we had to basically connect these high points. So we looked at a variety of alternatives for levee locations, and after several public meetings and much input from regulatory agencies and local community groups. This is basically what is moving forward as the preferred alternative, and it basically follows the existing levy. So there's not much terribly exciting to say here. This is an existing levy footprint. It seemed to be the most straightforward way to get flood protection in this levy. However, there's a couple of issues we have to deal with. One is we have to cross a railroad track. So raising this railroad track 8 to 9 feet up in the air means you have to run that track out several miles in both directions, extremely cost prohibitive. So they're looking at these swing gate structures to close that gap under a high tide event. So that's what's being examined for the railroad crossing. The other crossing, which is probably a little bit more interest to you guys, is Artesian Slough. We have to cross Artesian Slough, and this is where the Water Pollution Control Plant puts their effluent. So this is their freshwater effluent comes into Artesian Slough. So obviously we need to maintain at least unidirectional flow out toward the bay, and so we're looking at some sort of typical tide gate structure across the slough that during a high tide would close up, but it would still allow the freshwater effluent out into Artesian Slough. So those are some of the alternatives that are being examined. But another reason this was selected, apart from the economic impact potential of Alviso and the Water Pollution Control Plant, was the fact that if we put a levee in this location, it frees up a little over 2,000 acres for tidal marsh restoration. So all of these ponds out here and this pond A18, which is actually not part of the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project, this is owned by the City of San Jose, would then be available for restoration. We are limited on our ability to take down these levees until flood protection is in place for this community. So not only do we have the flood control benefits, but we also have the restoration benefits of choosing this location for the first phase of the shoreline study. And this is potentially some of the projections we've done of what the habitat would look like. These ponds are noticeably blank because restoration is already completed here, and I can get into that later if you want, but this has already been breached. We've reinforced the levee here. This is going to be a pond that will be managed specifically for shorebirds and wildlife. So the reason this is not included in the shoreline study is because we've actually completed restoration through here. But we did have to reinforce this levee, which by building the levee here, we won't have to do that work, which is expensive on these ponds. So this will free up quite a bit of acreage for restoration. And we're looking at this horizontal levee concept that you may have heard about, where instead of just restoring marsh and then having marsh come right up to an abrupt steep-sided levee, we're going to be building out these very gradual transition zones from upland into marsh. And it serves several purposes. One, that is a part of the ecosystem that's missing. Right, so we've developed on all these transitional habitats, and we have hard edges to our bay that are an abrupt transition to the tidal marshes where they even exist. And secondly, these actually provide really great wave attenuation, and they increase the longevity and efficacy of the flood control levees themselves. And so, here would be what the core levee would look like in cross-section, and we would build out artificially by placing fill to these gradual transition zones. And then under sea level rise scenarios, this gradual transition actually allows the marsh to kind of migrate inland. So as sea levels rise, this tidal marsh can start marching backwards toward the flood control levee. So it provides multiple purposes, and so that's what's on the table right now. And again, I probably don't need to explain this to you guys, but when you have steep-sided transitions next to the bay, you end up having to armor your levees, and you get a lot of erosion. But when you have these marshes in front of them with these transition zones, you can actually have a little bit lower levee, and you have much lower maintenance costs in the long term. And so these don't take these numbers to the bank. This is a moving target for us, but it's a little over $100 million projected for this, and that includes all of the restoration and all of the flood protection. There is a 65-35 federal to non-federal cost share. The non-federal sponsors have the majority of their cost share lined up, both in our contribution of the land, right? That has some costs, and then the Santa Clara Valley Water District in their ballot measure last year, their Safe Clean Water Initiative, they actually have $15 million set aside specifically as matching funds. So between those two, we're getting close to a little over $30 million in our match. This funding is going to require a WERDA authorization, and some of you may know that the Senate passed a WERDA bill, It is in the House right now, and we're trying hard to make sure that this project gets to a chief's report by next year so we can actually hopefully sneak in on this WERDA authorization and get funded that way. And then we're going to need a lot of dirt. So this is a big levee, and these are large transition zones. We're talking well over 3 million cubic yards of material that need to be brought into the area to build these features. So we're working on that as well. And the main point I wanted to bring up is, you know, we're here in 2013 now. We're going to be releasing an EIR this fall. September, October, you should be expecting to see a draft EIR out to the public. We'll have scoping meetings and all that. And we're hoping by the summer of 2014 to get to a chief's report. That means it's finalized, then we can go to Congress for federal funds. So that's kind of the schedule. We just wanted to give you an update, be available to answer your questions, and make sure you're aware that our EIR is coming out. And again, this could not be done alone. There's a lot of partners involved here. I won't name all of them. I'm available to answer questions now. I also have just three or four slides on the progress of the salt pond restoration project, if the board is interested in that, or we can just talk about shoreline study. So,
Board Member McGrath?
John, you have one of the coolest jobs in the world.
I think so, too.
And then you do it with panache. I appreciate it. A couple questions. You did indicate one of the concerns that I've had since this study first started is there might not be enough federal interest. You identified three areas out of 14 in the shoreline study. Is that all the only three at this stage that look like there's enough potential property damage for there to be a federal interest?
There were four. So two of them were in Palo Alto. I kind of lumped those together. So there, technically there were four. But, yes, it was the Palo Alto area, Sunnyvale, bordering on Mountain View. And then those were the ones that clearly rose to the top. There were others depending on which curve you looked at. There were a couple if you only looked at curve three, kind of met the smell test. But the problem is that the cost-benefit ratio that the Corps is – they have it's so competitive for federal funding nationwide – that the ratio you need of cost to benefit is, you know, on the order of, it used to be 1.5 to, as long as you were over 1 to 1, 1.5 to 1, you were good. We're at like 2 point something to 1. So there's a clear benefit, but we're being told that you may need 4, 5, 6 to 1 ratios to be competitive nationally. Yeah. So that is a concern
for
all of us.
So you have to do something really, really stupid in order to get
I guess the thing that I wanted to remind the rest of the board with is that there will remain substantial hazard from sea level rise in the South Bay. But we do have a very cool project. The other question that I had to do with Ravenswood. You guys are kind of stalled at Ravenswood with what you've done so far on the salt pond restoration project because of flood control hazard. And if that doesn't make a federal interest, so does this mean as bad a news for Ravenswood restoration as I kind of fear?
Well, I can talk about Ravenswood. I have a slide up here. I'll bring it up in a second. I want to address that directly, though. San Mateo County, that's in San Mateo County, did not move forward with the Corps of Engineers. They don't have as active a participation with us. The county's flood control agencies are not as big, as well-funded. You know, Alameda County sits on our project management team. Santa Clara Valley sits on our project management team. We have trouble engaging San Mateo County, so we're dealing with this largely through the San Francisco Creek Joint Powers Authority. Mm-hmm. They've applied for a grant to actually study and start developing plans for – because the fluvial and tidal flooding in that area are so intermixed, it's really hard to tease apart mm-hmm. where one ends and the other begins. We're partnering with them. Matter of fact, the refuge put up some matching funds for this grant that they just got to start – looking, and you know, Menlo's at the table, Redwood City's at the table, East Palo Alto's at the table. So we're trying to build it a little locally there and not go through the core process.
I think the reason is because most of our water is bought from SFPUC, a little groundwater from Cal Water, but we don't really have a superpower water agency like Santa Clara Valley,
exactly.
or East Bay Mud or Alameda or SF.
Yes,
we're all kind of fragmented, in my opinion.
But the flood hazard to the substantial assets of Silicon Valley and the constraints that puts on restoration make life difficult.
They do.
Achieving the goals of of maximizing.
And I would add that to your other point about there still being a risk, so the Corps is proposing so their basis of cost sharing is all based on that cost-benefit analysis. So what they'll cost share up to a certain level, and then if you want to add levels of protection or you want to do more restoration, then that's not cost shared. And what they're setting as their basis is the 25-year level of protection at year 50 under sea level rise, because that's where it pencils out in the sweet spot for them. However, the Coastal Conservancy and the Santa Clara Valley Water District want to bring that to 100-year level protection at year 50. So we're going to be responsible for that incremental cost. I mean, literally, we're talking 12 inches higher on the levee. And so if you're going to go through the process, the trouble of mobilizing, you know, an additional 12 inches, you got to do it. So that we're going to be footing the bill, I think, for that.
Get Silmar Hill.
So. So.
All right. Very good. So you want to pop a couple.
Do you want to do just? I promise, really
since,
quick.
Since Steve is here.
So
needs an update.
This is a map that shows all of our. We are celebrating our 10-year anniversary this year. So the acquisition occurred in 2003. So in 10 years, we acquired these 15,100 acres. Every call out you see on here was a phase one action, something that we covered. They're all complete except for these two small ponds right here and then the public access associated with E12 and 13. Those are currently under construction. They will be complete next year. When we're complete with phase one, we will have over 3,700 acres in some form of restoration. So we're pretty proud about that, going from acquisition to that much restoration in 10 years. But we're not resting on our laurels. We are pursuing very actively, in addition to the shoreline study area, other phase two projects. And so we have projects up here in the southern half of Eden Landing, in Ravenswood, and then in the Mountain View area in these ponds. And really quickly, Alameda County did not go with the Corps for a shoreline study. They're pursuing actually a pretty different approach, and we're working very closely with them to flood risk management. And that is building at the bay's edge a habitat / flood control feature and routing all of the water, which is what happened historically. There were not direct breaches out to the bay because of this, because of the morphology of the bay and the prevailing winds. This was always kind of a chenier ridge edge of the bay. So a lot of the drainages came in through these major channels. So we're going to be breaching into these marshes from the side. And so by the time this feature will damp the 100-year tide, and by the time the water winds its way back to here, it will have been damped enough that the existing levees are providing adequate flood protection. So by the time the water gets back here, it's already low tide out here, and it starts to drain. And they're doing extensive modeling on this right now. So we're gonna do this in phases. This is kind of a longer-term project. We're probably going to build an interim levee here, breach this area, monitor it extensively, make sure that the models are right, we want to verify, and then before we start breaching these ponds further back here. So that's what's being contemplated at Eden Landing.
So go back on that slide just one.
Sure.
This is key because on the right side of the slide where it says Bay Trail proposed, right above that is the Union Sanitary District's wastewater treatment plant. And so much like in San Jose, here's an area where we have infrastructure down in the Baylands that needs protection for its own water quality benefit.
And this light green area adjacent to here is again, kind of that gradual transition zone slope that we're thinking about creative, again, that will help damp the waves. But we're also talking with Mike Connor and others to maybe potentially beneficially reuse some of this water to create kind of this salinity gradient and a transition zone that might have more historically occurred. So we're exploring some of those things right now.
And John, in this area, the Alameda Creek flood control channel has filled up with sediment pretty rapidly and doesn't have the capacity. Now, this won't solve that completely, but the greater tidal prism that you'll be delivering will keep at least the seaward edge of this deeper and wider.
It will, and
so
that's...
it will deliver substantial flood control benefits.
Yes, and that's why the restoration here is pretty complicated. One, we want to... there's a lot of fish passage work going on in Alameda Creek, so we want to make sure we're providing the nursery habitat for those fish, right? I mean, this is a critical link in that whole system. But we have to be cognizant of the fluvial flooding issues as well as the tidal flooding issues. So this is a pretty complicated, it's on a little bit slower track just because it is so complicated, but this is kind of the thinking of where we are right now.
As we think about re-engineering our flood control systems for the 21st century and for rising sea level, the thing to remember about this is the Alameda Creek flood control system was predicated on the idea that you go out there and dredge the channel and you have this channel prism, and that was not realistic. We are moving towards things that are both lower maintenance and higher habitat value, and
that's the goal. Cool. That's the goal. Similarly, in Mountain View, we're looking at tidal marsh restoration of ponds A1 and A2W. This is the shoreline area, and this is also Charleston Slough, which is a mitigation pond, and then the Palo Alto flood basin. So instead of building a levee between a mitigation project and a restoration project, we're looking at combining these. This is, has some regulatory hurdles, but Charleston Slough was a mitigation that Cargill had for some of their pond maintenance, and 30-some-odd years later, there's still no tidal marsh in this area because it's operated under a complicated control gate structure, and so we're looking at hopefully being able to breach that and combine this into one large expanse of tidal marsh, again, which will help the tidal prism on these channels. But that does mean we may have to do some improvements along the Palo Alto flood basin levee to kind of close that flood control loop. So that's what we're thinking in Mountain View. And then in Ravenswood, and Jim, this gets to your point, we're looking at restoring pond R4. And this is out next to the bay. This is Ravenswood Slough. We can't do anything close. Here's the Facebook campus. Here's Highway 84. We're not at a point where we can introduce tides and the ponds over here as well because of the potential flooding on the highway. We are working with the city of Redwood City. Let me just back up for a second. Up to this point, everything I've pointed out in Phase 2 is tidal marsh restoration. You know, we did a lot of managed ponds and experimental stuff in Phase 1. We're still learning from all of that, so we're not quite at a point where we want to start replicating any of that. We still have a lot of knowledge to gain from those experiments. So we're really pushing forward with a lot of tidal marsh restoration in Phase 2. One, because of sea level rise, but two, because we're still trying to learn from those other experiments. But ponds R4, R5, and S5, these are small by our standards. This is combined about 60 acres. And under all of our scenarios, these were to be managed ponds. There's a lot of public access around here. They're very difficult ponds to manage. So we've actually been approached by the city of Redwood City to potentially take some of their, temporarily take some of their runoff and store it here during high events to prevent all the flooding that occurs in these trailer parks along here. Flooding occurs on an annual basis. Right now, right at that notch, the water enters the bay via flood slough directly, and so we would just hold some of that temporarily, then put it back out. And we're working with your staff right now to try and see. Obviously, we have water quality concerns about putting that water directly into these ponds, but we're trying to work through that to see if there's some solution that can be mutually beneficial. And so that's largely what we have planned for Phase 2.
That's a lot, so thank you.
It's really exciting stuff.
All right. Happy.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you. And Steve, you were part of that project years ago, too, with a number of other staff members here. So thank you, Ice. And when everyone was young and whatever. We're having our 50th class reunion this week from high school, and I kind of made a presentation at the high school the other day, and I said to the students, I said, it's probably about 2,000 pounds ago, too.
Yeah.
If you average it, and there was only 52 of us in our class, but you do the math, it looks like some have gained a little weight.
Be careful where you're going with that, Tom.
But I think that concludes it, Bruce. I don't know. I can't handle this afternoon. I've got to depart. I'm sorry, Jim.
Okay, then we will continue the closed session to future month. If there's,
do you want to have a closed session briefly?
I'd like to have the three of us sit here for about 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes, if we could.
You're certainly welcome to use upstairs. If
it's It'll take longer to get upstairs.
Bruce, where are we on the folders, I guess?
I've got them upstairs. I thought we were going to bed.
Did you officially
adjourn? There we go. So I can run up and get those, bring those
okay,
down.
Okay, why don't you give us about 10 minutes? And yes. And then bring them down?